rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, today was the day. Back in 1960, I realize many of you were not even born then, and I was a mere strapling of, 9 years old. But in 1960, today was the day when, mano a mano, Jack Kennedy mixed it up with Richard Nixon, the Nixon-Kennedy debates. And, you know, it's particularly interesting. There was a real telling moment in that Nixon-Kennedy debate in 1960. By the way, welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program. There was a real telling moment in that debate where the foundational and fundamental difference in the worldview between conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats, or however you want to define those categories, was just laid right out for everybody to see. And at the time, because the topic was like so in America's face, I think that for most people, they didn't realize what a huge contrast this was. Keep in mind, in 1960, when I was 9 years old, there were still, I still remember, it was a fancy restaurant downtown that had a side door that said colored entrance over the top of it. I mean, it wasn't until, 64 and then 67 that serious voting rights legislation was passed. It had just been 6 years earlier, 1954, that Brown versus Board of Education was decided. And Earl Warren, you know, wrote the decision, which gained him the eternal hatred of conservatives. I mean, that's why there was these impeach Earl Warren signs all over the United States in the 1960s, late 50s and 60s. Earl Warren wrote the decision that separate but equal was not acceptable, and African-American kids had to be allowed to attend school with white kids, even if it meant busing them into other neighborhoods, that integration was the law. I mean, that became the extension of it. I mean, with Brown versus Board of Education, it was basically, you know, this girl wanted, this young woman wanted to attend a white school that was actually near her home. And down in Alabama, they said, no, you can't do that. So this fundamental issue that shows the difference between the worldview of these two, and I'm reaching back to 1960 to point this out because we're still seeing this played out in so many different areas today, this fundamental difference in worldview about, do we solve society's problems by handing them over to corporations, or do we solve society's problem by saying, we as a society need to get together, figure out the solution, and do something about it? And if that involves bringing in a corporation, fine. If that involves the government doing something, fine. If it involves passing a law, fine. But we the people are going to do it, or at least decide how it gets done. The headline, the major screaming headline in the local paper here in Portland, Oregon today: no relief in sight for health costs. Great big picture of a woman in getting ready to get into an MRI machine. Healthcare costs clobbered Peggy Tate and sent her to economic purgatory after her husband died of cancer 5 years ago. 51-year-old Scappoose woman took out a second mortgage to pay $30,000 in costs not covered by her husband's insurance. He was insured. See, this is the real death tax. You hit middle age and then you hit old age, and they're going to make sure that they get every little penny out of your pocket, into the pockets of Bill Frist's daddy's corporation and others like it. So, how do we deal with the problems of society? Do we hand them off to corporations like the Bush administration? They want to privatize Social Security. They already have a privatized health insurance program or health program in the United States. Or do we, the people, say, no, wait a minute, we're going to deal with this as a society? Here's how Nixon and Kennedy addressed the issue of integration. Nixon's argument was, instead of complying with the law, or instead of we the people getting together and passing something like the Civil Rights Act that wasn't passed until 7 years later, that he would get together with the heads of industry and ask them to allow the lunch counters, ask them to allow African Americans to sit at the... He would get together with the head of Woolworths and say, well, why don't you let African Americans sit at the lunch counters? And Kennedy was saying, no, we're going to pass a law about this. Here, just take a listen.
I have talked to Negro mothers. I've heard them explain, try to explain how they tell their children how they can go into a store and buy a loaf of bread, but then can't go into that store and sit at the counter and get a Coca-Cola. This is wrong, and we have to do something about it. So under the circumstances, what do we do? Well, what we do is what the Attorney General of the United States did under the direction of the President. Call in the owners of chain stores and get them to take action.
That was Nixon's solution. And he was talking about what happened. He was Vice President of the United States at the time. And Eisenhower's Attorney General called in the heads of the chain stores and said, you know, we've got this problem. We've got these African Americans. They were referred to in 1960, not derisively, as Nixon just did, as Negroes. And he said, we've got these people who are, they want to sit at the lunch counters, and your companies won't allow them to. And now they're starting to protest, so why don't you let them sit at the lunch counters? That was Nixon's solution. Let's jawbone them. Let's just sit down with the corporations and ask them very nicely. Kennedy had a different reply. This is Kennedy's rebuttal.
Senator Kennedy.
Well, Mr. Nixon hasn't discussed the two basic questions. What is going to be done and what will be his policy on implementing the Supreme Court decision of 1954? Giving aid to schools technically that are trying to carry out the decision is not the great question. Secondly, what's he going to do to provide fair employment? He's been the head of the Committee on Government Contracts. He's carried out two cases, both in the District of Columbia. He has not indicated his support of an attempt to provide fair employment practices around the country so that everyone can get a job regardless of their race or color. Nor has he indicated that he will support Title III, which would give the Attorney General additional powers to protect constitutional rights. These are the great questions. Equality of education in schools. About 2% of our population white people is illiterate, 10% of our colored population. 60 to 70% of our colored children do not finish high school. These are the questions in these areas that the North and the South, East and West are entitled to know. What will be the leadership of the President in these areas to provide equality of opportunity for employment, equality of opportunity in the field of housing, which could be done on all federal supported housing by a stroke of the President's pen? What will be done to provide equality of education in all sections of the United States? Those are the questions to which the President must establish a moral tone and moral leadership. And I can assure you that if I'm elected President, we will do so.
And he did. And he did. I mean, just, you know, right, straightforward, stand up, and he did. And that today is, on this day in history, today in 1960, that debate was held. And the argument is still the same. You still have the conservatives out there saying, well, you know, yeah, we have social problems. There's social injustice. There's inequality. There's problems of poverty. There's problems of illness. There's problems of race. We just need to hand these things over to Bill Gates. He'll create a foundation. He'll take care of it. Or we just need to ask the corporations very nicely, would you please treat people well? And wait and hope. And because to do anything else would be big government. And you don't want big government, do you? And the Democrats have said, hey, wait a minute, government is us. We don't want big government like the Soviet Union. We don't want big government like Alberto Gonzalez listening in on our telephone conversations. We don't want without a warrant. We don't want big government like George W. Bush asserting his right to throw us into jail and never even tell us what we're charged with and leave us there literally for the rest of our lives without even having a trial, without even talking to an attorney, without even being able to call our family. No, we don't want that kind of big government. But if you're talking about our health, our welfare, if you're talking about the survival of human beings on this planet and in this country, if you're talking about equal rights in this country, then we, the people, have a role to play in this. We are not a society that was founded by rugged individualists who one at a time went out into the wilderness and created something out of nothing. We are a society of people who got together and did barn raisings as a community, who organized themselves together as communities, who came together in ways that were meaningful and powerful and positive as community. And that's how our government was organized, was as the voice of the people. And that's what we're seeing stripped away from us by this administration, repeatedly, over and over and over again. And that's what we need to be standing up for. And you can reduce all of these different issues that are going to be pivotal in the 2008 presidential election and are being discussed in this election right now along the same axis that you just heard Nixon and Kennedy arguing about. What is it? 46 years ago today. Yeah, and on this day in 1960. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. I want to be just like my president. I want to make more money than I can spend. I want to build more bombs than I can send. Somewhere I can even spell the name of. Welcome to the new American century.
And welcome back to The Pillow. I'll help you escape the Matrix. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Michael Medved, a nationally syndicated radio talk show host, he's on in probably most of the cities that we're on. Best-selling author, veteran film critic. I've been on his program a couple times. We've met a few times. A decent guy. Conservative talk show host, michaelmedved.com. His website, M-E-D-V-E-D. And, Michael, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom, and thanks for the kind words.
Great to have you with us. You wrote an article over at townhall.com that provoked me to say to my producer, David, we ought to get Michael on and talk about this, about proportionality in warfare, suggesting that there are folks out there saying that it's a terrible thing that 100,000 Iraqis have died when only 3,000 people died in 9/11, or that 1,000 people died in Lebanon when only 100 or so Israelis died, etc. And this just it astounds me that you're putting out this straw man argument, Michael, because in fact David spent the better part of a half hour yesterday doing every kind of Google search imaginable. We can't find anybody who's suggesting that there should be proportionality in warfare.
You can't find anyone who's suggesting there should. Then what was the denunciation of Israel all about regarding the fact that they had a disproportional response?
It was that their response was not successful. It was that it didn't accomplish what they wanted to accomplish, as you saw day before yesterday.
Enough, in other words,
well, it could be. I mean, you could argue that certainly, but the point is that nobody was saying that, to the best of my knowledge, particularly with regard to 9/11, which was the focus of your article, and this whole thing with Iraq that we should have proportional warfare. I mean, you go back to the example of World War II, you know, that we killed a lot of Japanese and a lot of Germans in order to win the war. Yeah. And I would say, by the way, that I think the world was horrified by that. And the rules of war, to a large extent, have changed since then, to some extent. I mean, it hasn't stopped us from building nuclear weapons. But why this notion that, you say, some critics of American policy cite the entire war on terror as a wildly disproportional overreaction. We lost 3,000 innocent civilians on September 11, and the Bush administration responded with the application of overwhelming force in Afghanistan and Iraq, perhaps resulting in 20 times as many deaths. We attacked the wrong people, Michael. That's the argument.
The argument is also disproportionality, and I've heard it with guests on my show, Tom. Some Sarah Taylor, who is the leader of the Drive Bush Out movement, I'm sure you're familiar with it, Tom, where they're trying to get people in the streets for October 5th, drive out the Bush regime, Bush must go.
Yeah, Michael, can you name one Democratic politician?
Well, let me tell you, that movement is supported by John Conyers, has lent his name to it, Maxine Waters, Pete Starr, congressman from California. There's 15 or 16 Democratic members of Congress who have signed those ads.
Are you suggesting, Michael, that there are no movements that you support that don't have people who say things that you don't support?
Well, I'm sorry, since Sarah Taylor is the director of that movement. Tom, I think you're being obtuse, if I may say so with all respect. There are tons of people out there who attack the United States, and certainly people who attacked Israel, based on this principle of disproportionality. That Israel overreacted to the kidnapping,
that
Israel overreacted to the kidnapping of its military personnel, that the United States overreacted on September 11th. And it's one of those things. George Galloway was on my show and was making that case.
He's not even an American. I mean, the argument that I'm hearing, Michael,
is a hero to the international.
The argument that I'm hearing is not that it was a disproportional response, but that it was an ineffective response. It was a stupid response. The Bush administration attacking Iraq over 9/11 is like us attacking Brazil because we were hit at Pearl Harbor.
Okay, and I, of course I've heard that argument, Tom, and I think that's an interesting argument to have. My counter to that, of course, is that if the Bush doctrine was correct, which is that you need to treat regimes that support terrorism the same way that you treat the terrorists themselves, there were no regimes on earth, none, that supported terrorism as a principle as openly as Saddam Hussein's Iraqi regime.
Not true. Saudi Arabia was holding fundraisers on TV for money for suicide bombers in Israel. Fundraisers on TV.
Okay. Again, very different from individual Saudis holding fundraisers and the government of Iraq paying suicide bombers. And by the way, after 9/11,
this was the government of Saudi Arabia that was doing this.
Every Arab state, including Iran and Libya, condemned the 9/11 attacks.
Michael, you had a Saudi prince that George Bush kissed on the face on television, raising money to send money to the families of suicide bombers, and you're saying that no other country
Saddam Hussein supported it more ostensibly or more flagrantly. There was no other nation on earth that supported terrorism as outspokenly as Saddam Hussein's Iraq. No other country on earth where the government applauded the attacks of 9/11, except for Afghanistan and Iraq. That's it.
Yeah, well, Michael, Michael Medved.com. Michael Medved, good talking with you today, Michael.
Great to talk to you, Tom. Good luck to you.
Thanks.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I was feeling sad and kind of blue. I didn't know what I was gonna do. The communists were coming around. They were in the air. They were on the ground. They were all over.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Announcing the October surprise contest on the Tom Hartman program message blogs. First person to post the correct answer to what's the Bush administration's October surprise, and of course we'll figure that out November 13th, gets an autographed copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. The day after the election, we'll be putting up a poll so members can vote on the winner and four runners-up. Each will receive an autographed copy of Screwed. The winners will be announced on November 13th. And, boy, it takes a lot to get me speechless. It really does. And I was shocked. What can I say? I never complain, never explain. But to say that because Saddam Hussein said 9/11 was a good thing, therefore we should have invaded him. And the music had started. And at that point, I'm like, what? Did I really hear that? But what can I say? Michael Medved is good. He's good at what he does. Bill in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Bill.
Hello, Tom. I got to tell you, I love your show. Discovered it over Sirius Radio, and have been listening to you online as well. But boy, that drove me crazy. That guy just now. You were making the point, but what really got me nuts is it almost seemed like you let them get away before you nailed them. At the very end, I was trying to,
the music had started, and I knew I had like 7 seconds.
Yeah,
and I'm like, okay.
Well, I wish you could have hung on to him for about another.
Well, and he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't do it. We'd asked him, will you come on for another segment? No, won't do it.
Yeah.
And
that sounds like kind of hit and run tactics.
Yeah, and it was, well, you know, I mean, maybe that's all the time he could do. I mean, but it's like, whoa, yeah, did I really hear that? I mean, as of yesterday, more people have died as a result of Bush's war in Iraq than died in 9/11.
It's just hideous.
And this is justified because Saddam Hussein allegedly said 9/11 was a good thing?
Absolutely.
I was just like, did I really hear that? And then the break, you know, and so anyhow.
Yeah. He was calling you obtuse. I was livid. I lost.
Yeah.
You know, I also listened to Bill Press in the morning, and a statement that he had said this morning. He says, when one of these righties come up to you and slap you on the face like that, you don't do what every liberal or progressive has done in the past, which is turn the other cheek. He says, you turn around, and I'm not talking about literally, but you turn around, you verbally smack them in the mouth, kick them in the gut, stomp on them when you got them down. I'm not talking about literally. Please understand, I'm not that way.
No, well, I mean, we do that in this program several days
a
week. You know, I mean,
I've heard you,
I make a living doing that.
Don't let these guys, I mean, get a death grip on these guys. They have got to stand up and answer for the crap that they have been putting out on the American people all these years.
Yeah, well said, Bill. Thanks a lot. Bill in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Tom. This Michael Medved, I followed his show pretty closely. Frankly, he was a breath of fresh air when he first came on because he was a step up from Rush Limbaugh, definitely.
Well, he would put the other folks on the other side. In fact, I was on his show twice, and both times he had me on for a whole hour. And he would bring in his callers and everything, you know, all that kind of thing. What's interesting to me is that I think now, by and large, those, and I can't speak for Michael's show because I haven't listened to it in a couple of years, but by and large, what I'm finding is that the conservative programs that occasionally allow a liberal through, and there's a thing in Think Progress about this today, of just trying to call, they tried to call 6 radio shows, 3 conservative, 3 liberal, and what they found was that the conservative shows let, you know, with an opposing viewpoint, the conservative shows let, the liberal shows let the opposing viewpoint through, the conservative shows didn't. And Medved does, but mostly he looks for, like, you know, the loony fringe.
His take and some of the things he said, he's spread some despicable lies and said some horrible things about. Basically, it's a systematic effort to destroy any Democratic figure that has any reputation at all. He said that FDR was a traitor because there was a couple hour gap between the time FDR, you know, that he found out there was an attack coming on Pearl Harbor and they started mobilizing our forces, and yet he calls Churchill the man of the century, who had thousands, tens of thousands die in Coventry in bombing raids. I mean, he said horrible things about Gore and Kerry and every Democrat.
Well, I'm not going to turn the program into Trash Michael Medved Day or any other conservative, but the argument that the death of nearly 3,000 American soldiers in Iraq and the dismemberment and maiming of 20,000 and the death of 150,000 civilians in Iraq is justified by Saddam Hussein somehow saying that 9/11 was a good thing just you know, boggles my mind. I just have to say it boggles my mind. So, Bill, thanks a lot for your comments. Steve in Bremerton. Hey, Steve.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Good. I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Listen, I'll just make this real quick. You know, you got a good program there, but I just kind of go crazy sometimes when I hear Michael Medved over in our area. And you know, what frustrates me about Democrats is they don't take on these Republicans more in terms of their kind of hypocritical views about this war and stuff. And I'll give you an example of Michael Medved. You know, look, I grew up in the late 60s like you, early 70s, and I remember talking to all my Republican friends about Vietnam, and, you know, all of them thought we ought to be there, but when it came to going over there and doing some fighting, none of them showed up. You know, that's just so typical of Republicans. And people need to take a guy like Medved on. He's nothing but a draft-dodging coward. And I know you don't want to turn this into a trash Michael Medved, but the guy just drives me crazy. He's just... He's just another example to me of one of these hawk Republicans that's, you know, Dan Quayle and all these guys, Bush and all Cheney. We all.
Well, Cheney hasn't stuck it around, you know, so that he can you know have this conversation with you. I'm disappointed. But,
oh, okay.
You know, it's he had to go. So,
yeah.
Anyhow,
but you know, it just frustrates me that more guys don't take these guys on because when it came to
I'll take him on anytime he wants.
Fighting, they never showed up.
Yeah,
that's all I have to say. But
yeah, I'll take him on anytime he wants to come on the program. And as you know, we take these guys on. You know,
well, you know, you took him on good, but I'd like you took him on good, Tom. But because the bottom line was he didn't answer the last. I mean, he never came and answered your question.
Yeah.
But anyway, so
thanks a lot, Steve. Bruce in Leesburg, Florida. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Oh, how's it going, Tom? Yeah, I'd talked to Colt Michaels' program before, and I'd made reference that basically, you know, I said Prescott Bush and his ties with the Nazis and supporting Hitler in World War II and how he'd lost, you know, businesses. And basically what he did was he was like, liar, 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 and then he hung up on me.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's his prerogative as a talk show host. I get it. I want to move along from this and get to there's a larger issue here than just one particular talk show host. And that larger issue is that there is a right-wing spin machine out there that is working very, very aggressively. For example, you've got the Murdoch-owned Fox News setting up Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton fights back. And the minute a Democrat fights back, God forbid a Democrat should fight back, the minute Bill Clinton fights back, the Murdoch-owned New York Post does an hour-long interview with Condi Rice. This is right after the CBS-owned 60 Minutes does a 20-minute fluff piece on Condi Rice about, oh, she was the child of slaves and grew up in poverty and she did so well and isn't this marvelous? Following that, then you get the New York Post saying, well, you know, what about Bill Clinton? And, well, to quote the Washington Post, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice yesterday accused Bill Clinton, this is in the New York Post, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice yesterday accused Bill Clinton of making flatly false claims that the Bush administration didn't lift a finger to stop terrorism before the 9/11 attacks. What we did, Rice said, in the 8 months was at least as aggressive as what the Clinton administration did in the preceding years. Yeah, right. Here's what Clinton did when he was presented on December 4th, 1998, with a presidential daily briefing titled, Bin Laden Preparing to Hijack U.S. Aircraft and Other Attacks. Quote from the 9/11 Commission. The same day, counterterrorism czar Richard Clark convened a meeting of his counterterrorism security group to discuss both the hijacking concern and the anti-aircraft missile threat. To address the hijacking and warning, the group agreed that New York airports should go to maximum security starting that weekend. They agreed to boost security at other East Coast airports. The CIA agreed to distribute versions of the report to the FBI and FAA to pass to the New York Police Department and the airlines. The FAA issued a security directive on December 8th with specific requirements for more intensive air carrier screening of passengers and more oversight of the screening process at all three New York airports. That's what Clinton did the day after he got the briefing, or the day that he got the briefing. On August 6, 2001, Bush gets a similar briefing. Bin Laden determined a strike in the U.S. And here's what the 9/11 Commission report said. President Bush, in our interview, did not recall discussing the August 6th report with the Attorney General or whether Condoleezza Rice had done so. We found no indication of any further discussion before 9/11 among the president and his top advisors of the possibility of a threat of an al-Qaeda attack toward the United States. Tenet does not recall any discussions with the president of the domestic threat during this period. None! Time now for the Progressive Pop Quiz, the Tom Hartman radio program. Sixth caller with the correct answer, 866-440-8466, gets an autographed copy of Screwed. Our question, what debate was held on this day in 1960?
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, and I was feeling near faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained. They rode us all the way to New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I sang soft while Bobby sang the blues. When she wipers clapping time, I told Bobby Sandman we sang every song that Javi knew. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, I mean nothing, honey, if it ain't free.
And welcome back, 9 minutes before the hour. Man, I could listen to Janis Joplin all day long, exposing the con and conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. Congratulations. Our progressive pop quiz, our question once again, what debate was held on this date in 1916? Congratulations to John Martin. There you go. John's a truck driver who lives in Portage, Pennsylvania, and he knew that the correct answer is the Nixon-Kennedy debate. In 1960, the presidential debates, and John wins a copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It.
Get Screwed by Tom Hartman.
There you go. Yeah, as they say in the commercials, yes. We got to change that one of these days, Alex. Vic in Cedar Creek, Texas. Hey, Vic.
Yeah, you know you love that commercial.
I do. I actually do. What's up?
More people in one. Well, you started off the show talking about the corporations and what corporations are doing to America. And I, like you, don't confuse it with capitalism. But something that I have framed, and it's a quote. I love the quotes of our founding fathers and others who describe or at least warn us about the things in the future. And my favorite one, other than the one Madison saying, if tyranny ever comes to this land, it'll come in the guise of a foreign enemy. The one I like is, if the American people ever allow the private banks to control the issue of their money, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that grow up around the banks will deprive the people of their property until their children will wake up homeless on a continent their forefathers conquered. What foresight this guy happened, and I think every day, I think of that quote every day, and I think, here we are. It's come full circle. We did not heed the warning.
You know, this was a big debate between Jefferson and Hamilton at the founding of this country. Hamilton wanted there to be a national bank. The Constitution gives to Congress the power, the sole power, actually, to mint and coin money.
Correct.
And Hamilton felt that, therefore, the government should be able to own a bank and not just mint and coin money, but also be in the business of banking. And Jefferson was of the opinion that the government should not be in that business. The banks should be private entities using the currency created by the United States, but that they should be private entities. Hamilton prevailed, and there were two banks of the United States, that the second one failed in, as I recall, 1836. I mean, that's what the Andrew Jackson election campaign really was all about. Jackson, that second bank went bank, was it 1836 or 1846? The second Bank of America went bankrupt in Philadelphia.
Right. You know? Well, I know exactly what you're talking about, because when I ran for Congress in the 90s as an independent, my platform was to abolish the Federal Reserve, and that's where you're going with
it. Well, here's the problem
and
with it.
Everybody's eyes would just glaze over, and they would.
I know, and people tend not to understand it. And there's this movie coming out from Freedom to Tyranny, which is basically a libertarian hit job on taxation. I mean, they're promoting the one of the main Republican Grover Norquist libertarian memes of, those tax dollars are your money, and the 16th Amendment wasn't legitimately passed, and therefore we shouldn't be paying taxes, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in the process, they bring in this whole, you know, Jekyll Island thing about the Fed. And, yeah, I've got some concerns about the fact that the Fed is actually, while it's created by government, brought in. It's a federally chartered organization. That is the Constitution doesn't provide for the creation of corporations. They're supposed to be created by the states.
Right.
But this is a federally created corporation, but it's not owned by the federal government. It's owned by its member banks. There's 12 of them, as I recall. And those banks are owned by their stock, by the banks that own stock in them. So, for example, I used to live in Montpelier, Vermont. The bank that I banked with, I didn't own any stock in it, but I could have bought it just as easily. In fact, they would regularly pitch it to their people who had, you know, checking accounts, was the Chittenden Bank. Chittenden Bank was part of the Fed. They owned stock in the Boston Federal Reserve Bank. That was privately owned by a bunch of banks, and then you could buy stock in those banks. And then the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston was one of the 12 banks that owns the Fed. And so it's all privately held. Now, a lot of people are very, very concerned about that. They see it as part of some giant conspiracy, and it's, you know, ripping off America and whatnot. But the reality is, And this is what I haven't found a good answer to this, Vic, and maybe you can enlighten me. Prior to the creation of the Fed, we had this horrible, horrible series of cycles that started in the 1890s of boom and bust, of state banks coming up and then going bankrupt, of private banks going into existence and going bankrupt, of people losing their savings, their life savings, people getting wiped out, nationwide depressions, the Great Depression of 1896, as I recall it was, the Great Depression of 1846. I mean, those are two big ones, but there was a whole, about every 10, 15 years, there'd be one of these things. And since the creation of the Fed, it's really evened out a lot. What's the alternative?
Well, the Fed has done it, you know, with inflation and deflation. But the fact that back in those days there was no, Congress didn't.
That argues for going back to the gold standard, you know, which Nixon took us off in 72. But I'm not talking about the gold. Say what?
We don't have enough gold to cover our.
Well, there is that. Vic,
thank you, Tom.
Yeah, good to hear from you. We'd have enough gold if we simply revalued our currency, but boy, would that be a mess. Anyhow, that's one where I have spent the better part of 20 years looking at this thing, and I'm not sure that the Fed was such a bad thing, frankly, because I don't know what the alternative is. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. We have just a few months, less than 2 months, 50-some-odd days here before the election's coming up. What are you doing? Are you getting involved? Are you out there volunteering? Have you participated? Have you sent $25 to a campaign or whatever you can afford? I mean, just voting isn't going to be enough this time around. Just voting is not enough. Jack Cafferty, hey, caught you doing something right. You know, every now and then somebody does something really, really right. And I'd like to acknowledge, I think it's better to catch people doing things right than catching people doing things wrong, which is standard management technique. And Jack Cafferty, the curmudgeonly Republican conservative over on CNN, yesterday on Wolf Blitzer's show, The Situation Room, lays this out.
Sometimes politicians say really dumb things. Check this out.
I like to tell people when the final history is written on Iraq, it'll look like just a comma. My point is there's a strong will for democracy.
A comma in the history books. That was in an interview with Wolf Blitzer. That particular clip ran yesterday in his Sunday program. Well, Mr. President, here's what that comma looks like so far. 2,700 American soldiers dead. 20,000 Americans seriously wounded, arms and legs blown off, things like that. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis dead, including women and children, the wholesale slaughter of innocent civilians, many of these people tortured before they're murdered, just because they happen to get caught in the waves of secular rage that are sweeping through that country. It's violence unlike anything I can remember, and the United States and the Iraqi government are powerless to control it. An increase in the terrorist threat to the United States as a result of President Bush's decision to invade Iraq. That's according to the latest national intelligence estimate. We'll have more on that later in the third hour of the Situation Room. And appropriations from the U.S. Treasury to pay for all this, totaling $500 billion and counting.
Half a trillion dollars. Well, good on you, Jack Cafferty, for pointing that out. And it's just every now and then somebody, somehow it just kind of sneaks through the mainstream media. Somebody says something that approximates the truth, you know. And what can I say? Good on you, Jack Cafferty. I want there are a bunch of things in the news that I want to get to. This week is, in all probability, going to be the week, the last opportunity that we'll have before Congress goes on into recess to talk to members of Congress. Where they all go out and, you know, go home and start campaigning and all this kind of stuff, the run up to the election, about whether or not they're going to allow, whether or not they're going to give George Bush a pass, and with regard to torture, with regard to habeas corpus, which is arresting people and not charging them with a crime or giving them a trial, but just simply keeping them in jail for forever, and with regard to illegal wiretapping, whether Congress is going to give George W. Bush a pass on these three things. And that's what the compromise, in quotes, that McCain and Lindsey Graham and John Warner have worked out. It basically gives George Bush a pass, and it eviscerates the rights of habeas corpus, which we'll get into in some more detail in the program as time goes on. And I do want to talk about that, and in fact suggest to you that this is a really urgent issue, and you should be calling your member of Congress or your and both your senators toll-free at 866-808-0065. And letting them know that you don't think that the Bush administration should get a pass on destroying habeas corpus, on illegal wiretapping, and on torture. That no legislation should be passed that gives them a pass on this. We have laws on the books right now. We have the War Crimes Act that has to do with the detention of prisoners or the torture of prisoners. It's very explicit. We have habeas corpus laws, including the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Amendments to the Constitution. We have this. We have a law about illegal wiretapping. It's called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. We don't need to pass a law to say, well, if George W. Bush broke these three laws, he can't go to jail. He can't be impeached. He didn't do anything wrong. We don't need a new law. We have laws about this. Bush broke them. Cheney broke them. Rumsfeld broke them. Rice broke them. And I realize that there are a number of senators who have been out there speaking on behalf of the administration who could be held to account, according to some legal scholars. And they're afraid that they could be prosecuted for this. It was on this Congress's watch that these war crimes were committed. I mean, we held responsible members of the German legislature after World War II. Not all of them, a few. Bill Frist might be concerned. Maybe that's why he's pushing so hard. Filibuster, you guys can't overcome a... come on, Bill. Call your member of Congress, toll-free, 866-808-0065. Our new toll-free number for Congress. 866. Yeah, no, I get it right. 866-808-0065. Or if you can call direct and not, you know, burn up the toll-free number, but call direct if you have unlimited long-distance minutes or whatever, or are willing to pay for the call and can afford to pay for the call, 202-225-3121, the main switchboard on Capitol Hill, 202-225-3121, and ask for your member of Congress. Now, I want to get into this in more detail, but I raised this issue of banking just before we wrapped up the last hour. It's an issue that intrigues me and that I'm not only fascinated by it, but I am concerned that it is going to be a very big issue in the next 6 to 8 months as this economy begins to unravel, particularly after the elections. And I see we have a couple of callers on this, so I just wanted to get into it and see what they have to say. Dave in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Dave, thanks for calling the program. What's up? Dave?
A quick quote from one of your favorite founders is the from Thomas Jefferson. It's his quote is, "The banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than the standing
armies." Yeah, yeah.
And
he strongly believed that. But what do we do?
Well, I'd like to recommend some. I'm not very well versed in this, although I've been getting into it lately. And on the central bank, it's pretty much a myth that they are stabilizing these boom-bust cycles. That in fact, their job is to create them. And when Jackson got rid of the central bank...
Now, you're talking about Andrew Jackson in the 1830s.
That's right. And he would not renew that charter. And he wanted it, you know, when asked...
Right, First National Bank.
Exactly. And when he was asked how he wanted to be remembered... He just said one thing, and that was, "I killed the central bank."
Right. Well, that's what he campaigned on. That's why he was elected.
And when that was allowed to expire, that boom-bust cycle pretty much disappeared until the 1890s, as you correctly said.
Well, no, there was a major panic. It was called the Panic of 46, and there was another panic in the 50s. I think it was 56 or 57, 1856 or 1857. In fact, some suggest that panic of the 1850s was one of the things that was the trigger for the Civil War. Because so many small farmers in the North were wiped out by it.
Yeah, and Lincoln had a great deal to do with that, with the greenbacks, as far as the economy goes, I recall.
Well, see, this is the thing. I make no pretenses to being. I'm not a scholar of the history of banking in the United States.
Nor am I. And there's a film out there, an old film, 10 years old, that's on the Internet. Anybody can watch it. It's called The Money Masters.
Yeah.
And it's one of the best films on this topic, and shows how that central banking and how paper money works and how fractional banking works.
No, I understand that, and I understand how the, you know, banks can create money out of nothing, you know, by lending money but see, we set the rules for that. We say, okay, a bank can loan, you know, they only have to have, say, for example, 10% reserve. So that means the bank starts out with $100. That's their reserve. So they can loan out $1,000. They just invented $900 out of nothing.
That's right, out of
nothing.
They
created it out of thin air. And that $1,000 then works its way through the economy, generates some real wealth, comes back to the bank as, say, $500, and now they can create $5,000, you know, or they can loan $5,000, which creates $4,500 out of thin air. I understand that and the inflationary nature of that. But the fact of the matter is that the rules about how much the bank has to have in reserve, I don't
it's
think...
It's done by the Fed.
Are you sure?
Yes, I am.
I thought it was the Treasury Department.
No. In fact, I'll send you an article. There's an excellent article that was written in a financial newsletter that really puts this into perspective as to how that's done and how the auditors, the Fed sends out the auditors and tightens up the money supply.
Yeah.
And on the loans by discrediting them. But I recommend The Money Masters. It's a really good film on this.
Okay, I'll check it out, Dave. I'd love to see it because I just, you know, I understand the problems, and I understand that the bankers are getting rich at the expense of everybody else. You know, Jefferson was right about that. I just don't know what the solution is.
They're the ranchers of the middle class of the
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they're harvesting us, as it were. Dave, thanks for the call. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I left Kentucky back in 49 and went to Detroit working on assembly line. The first year they had me putting wheels on Cadillacs. Every day I'd watch them beauties roll by, and sometimes I'd hang my head and cry, 'cause I always wanted me one that was long and black. One day I devised myself a plan that should be the envy of most any man. I'd sneak it out of there in a lunchbox in my hand.
Uh-oh.
Now, getting caught meant getting fired, but I figured I'd have it all by the time I retired. I'd have me a car worth at least $100,000. I'd get it one piece at a time, and it wouldn't cost me a dime. You'll know it's me when I come through your town.
And welcome back to the radio support group up by and for We the People of the United States of America. Yeah, one piece at a time. That's how you take an election. That's how you take a country back. 1-866-440-8466, our toll-free number, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And let's just wrap up this conversation about the banking industry. A couple more calls here. Craig in Linwood, Washington. Hey, Craig.
Yes, sir. What I wanted to talk about is the fact that in what I've been reading recently is that a lot of the people, or a lot of the syndicate bankers who are behind the funding of Hitler,
yeah,
are the same ones who have been behind the dismantling of, like, the steel industry and the auto industry. The same groups or the same leaders have been doing things behind the scenes to help in the defunding, because they've worked both the union side and management side as consultants. And the idea is this whole globalization thing, that they don't want a nation state, because that gives us, the people, too much power.
Sure, this is what George Herbert Walker Bush declared when he said, you know, we're seeing a new world order emerging.
Yes, I mean, and that's the whole purpose, is to give us in each of our countries less and less power to have any say.
Absolutely. And that's what the WTO is all about. I'll give you that. So what do we do about that? I mean, obviously, with regard to trade agreements, we roll those back. But
have to go back to a Roosevelt united political economy, which originally started the country on its path of breaking us from England and all that, where we actually create like a 50-year low interest loans to start rebuilding the infrastructure, what Roosevelt wanted to do, where we start rebuilding our water systems and stuff that have just been let go into collapse.
But he just did that by issuing treasury bonds. I mean, he did that by government debt, the same way Bush is paying for his tax cuts for the billionaires and millionaires, and the same way that Bush is paying for the war in Iraq.
Yes, but his was producing infrastructure.
No, I understand that. I mean, it was an appropriate use of debt rather than an inappropriate use of debt, but he was simply using government debt to do it.
Yes, but right now we're in that situation where we need to start putting people back to work at jobs that pay.
Yeah, and but I don't think that we're at the point where the government has to be the employer of last resort. I think that instead what we need to do is we need to change the rules of the game of business and say we're going to go back to tariffs, we're going to protect domestic industries, we're going to bring jobs back into the United States.
I agree with all that, too.
Yeah, and we're going to reduce the labor force to the point where the cost of labor is going to go up by saying that only people who are citizens of the United States can actually work in the United States. I mean, this is just really simple, fundamental stuff. It's Econ 101. But that doesn't still solve the problem, or the question, rather, of that is going to be, I'm guaranteeing you, this is going to be a hot issue over the next couple of weeks, particularly as Aaron Russo's movie comes out, which is, what about the banking system? How does it play into all this? And then on top of that, you know, should there be an income tax and should people pay taxes? And it's going to turn into this whole libertarian argument that the Republicans are going to take and run with, and they're going to vacuum up a bunch of progressives or Democrats along the way who don't understand these issues. I get it that we have the commons, we have, you know, things that we want in the United States to have. We want to have stop signs and street lights and police and fire and streets that, you know, we can travel on, and public schools. And there has to be a way to pay for those. And we've decided that the way to pay for those is with, among other things, an income tax. You know, I get all that, and that's the price of civil society, and that it's just a right-wing talking point to say, oh, it's your money and that kind of thing. And I get that if employers right now are paying people and say a third of their money is going to taxes, so somebody's being paid $10 an hour, they're taking home $7 an hour, or $6.66 an hour. Say they're taking home $7 an hour. That if you were to simply do away with all the taxes, what, you think the employers are going to continue to pay them $10 an hour? They already know they'll work for $7 an hour take home. They just start reducing their wages. So that's no solution. I mean, you know, doing away with the taxes is no solution.
But
so,
we also have to go back to where we can't get rid of our tool and die industry like we're doing, because we have to have that $20 and $35 an hour blue-collar work.
I agree, but the way to do that is with tariffs. The way to do that is to do away with the trade agreements. That has nothing to do with the banking.
Also to start rebuilding our infrastructure.
What's
the stuff you can't ship out?
No, I agree. And there are easy solutions there, because they worked in the United States for 220 years. But what's the alternative to the banking situation that we have? That's what nobody, I mean, I have been looking into this thing for 25, 30 years. I've been doing this program for 4 years. I have had a dozen banking experts on, including, you know, people who wrote books about, you know, Jekyll Island and the Fed and, you know, gold and everything else. And nobody has been able to say, well, here's what the alternative should be. And I'm looking for that. I'm looking for that. I'd love to hear it. You know, if any of our callers have an idea, what do you do as an alternative to the Fed? Educate me, which is, I'll bet you never heard, think, I thought you'd hear me say that. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The machines don't leave no paper trail. The billionaires don't want you to vote this year. We'll send you a message that's loud and clear that the votes can't be counted in your community. Why even register? Don't waste your energy. Don't go to the polls on election day, because we bought the election and it better go our way. And on election night, we'll sit back and gloat. The billionaires don't want you to vote. If you're happy with George Bush in charge, if you want to keep us living large, do you really want to rock the boat? Hey, the billionaires don't want you to vote.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Paul Weyrich, Republican strategist. The billionaires, they don't want you to vote. No, sorry, Bob. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Aaron Russo's movie is great, and I can tell you that the
have you seen the movie or just the trailer?
The whole thing. The movie is great, and it is the neo-fascist Republican-controlled airwaves television I'm talking about that's been keeping Aaron Russo off the air. CNBC was going to interview him. They saw his movie, then they got back to him. They said, maybe we don't want to interview you after all. Now, it's true the film is primarily about the IRS and the Federal Reserve, but there's a lot of other issues in that movie that he gets into. This movie is hardly going to be any kind of a talking point for the Republican Party. The Republican Party wants to stay as far away from this movie as they possibly can.
Interesting. Well, I've seen the 14-minute trailer on the web. I haven't seen the whole movie, but my co-host in the morning show, Heidi Tauber, has, and I'm going to have Aaron on the program this week, and I'm going to borrow the DVD that Heidi has and watch the thing, and I'll give you a more authoritative report on it. But from what I saw from the trailer, it Aaron Russo, you know, ran for president as a libertarian. He was beaten by Michael Badnarik on like the 8th or 10th round. I mean, over and over, you know, he nearly was the libertarian candidate for president in 2004.
That's right.
And the libertarians have, in my opinion, an awful lot of toxic philosophy. And, you know, whether or not the 16th Amendment was ultimately ratified, you know, the fact of the matter is that we have it. I mean, it's not going to go away. So.
Well, I'm not calling to argue with you about that. I'm very clueless about, you know, the banking system and all that myself. But I think Aaron Russo is very, very, very good as libertarians go. In fact, he's too good for the Libertarian Party. He hates George Bush's guts. I can tell you he believes in a heavy, heavy tariff system. You know, as far as what to do about, you know, like if you got rid of income taxes, I've never talked to him about it, about what he would do instead of that. But
well, that's the question, Joe. I mean, that's ultimately the question, what it comes back to. I mean,
there's a lot of libertarians. I do know there are a lot of libertarian types. I believe they believe in like putting in a, you know, like national sales tax or something like that. So I don't know that's what he believes in doing, but you know, a lot of them are like that.
Yeah, or what the European countries are doing with what's the tax that they call, where they tax everything all the way along, you know, at every stage of production, you know, you add a little tax to it, and
a
value added tax, the VAT,
but it's a great movie. I mean, there's a lot to disagree with in the movie, and there's a lot to agree with. It's a good movie to me because it's entertaining and it's kind of funny. You don't have to agree with everything.
I'll check it out. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Lynn in Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, Lynn.
Oh, hi. Yes, you wanted to know, I'm not sure this is necessarily knowledge, but you wanted suggestions about what to do with the banking system.
Yeah, I'm just curious if anybody has offered a solution, you know, to something as an alternative to the Fed. Because, you know, like I said, I watched this debate, as it were, you know, reading the history books between Jefferson and Hamilton. And Hamilton won at first, and then it looked like Jefferson was vindicated when, you know, by the time Andrew Jackson came along. And then we kind of stumbled through the 19th century, and basically we saw the rise of an oligarchy, you know, the robber baron.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then the Fed was created in 1913, and some argue that the creation of the Fed even was one of the things that contributed to the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
It's arguable, but I can't deny it. You know, I can't prove that it's not the case. But on the other hand, there are those who suggest that the Fed has done very well. And in fact, the Fed has been copied by the Federal Reserve, you know, by central banks in, I think, all of the major industrialized nations of the world.
Well, wouldn't one suspect from that because the bankers have been so well served by the Federal Reserve that, of course, bankers internationally would adopt that?
Well, you could. I mean, you know, if you want to take the conspiracy view of it, which may well be true, or it could be that the countries adopt it because it works.
Well, the suggestion that I have, and it's not my suggestion, I just happen to remember a friend of mine has been deeply researching the JFK story for a film, and you know, he discussed with me at some length that JFK was very interested, and I think there was even an executive order that would have placed the Federal Reserve under the direction of the U.S. Treasury.
In other words, make it no longer a private institution, but a public institution.
Exactly.
Nationalize the Fed.
Right. Right, and you know there are of course conspiracy theories.
Yeah, that's enough to get you assassinated.
Forming around at that because he did it right before he was not long before he was assassinated.
Yeah.
But he did numbers of things that ticked people off. So
yeah.
There's enough fodder
there
for everybody.
Yeah, in particular, he was upsetting the mob, in my opinion. But interesting. Should we nationalize the Fed? I mean, you know that might be a solution. Nationalize the Fed and go back to a gold standard. That
because
seems like
a good synthesis. And then Nixon, of course, dropped the gold standard. But
right.
It seems to me that the way things are set up right now, instead of the public, the Commonwealth, regulating the flow and values of monies in this country and within our international commerce, we have the private industry, the banking industry, dictating to us, the citizens, how it's going to be.
It's absolutely right.
That's backwards in my view.
Yeah. Well, I'm not disagreeing with you, and it makes a lot of sense to nationalize the banking industry. It would be interesting to find out if any other countries have done that and what their experience has been. You know, other than tin pot dictatorships, I know that there are many that have.
I mean, one of the things that China's been doing recently has been investing very, very heavily in the gold market.
But China's largest bank is doing an IPO this week. It's going to be the large. They're looking at I forget the numbers. It was in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, but you know, I want to say it was $6 trillion or some mind-boggling amount. It couldn't have been $6 trillion. Maybe it was $6 billion. Some mind-boggling amount of money that they're going to do as an IPO. It's going to be the largest bank IPO in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, they're going with private banks. So now that doesn't mean that they have a central banking system. I need to learn more about that. Lynn, I got to move along, but
okay.
Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yep, you too. Rich in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Rich.
Hey, Tom, I'll tell you what, as long as you're doing better, we're all getting better.
There you go. Thank you, Rich.
Yeah, I tell you what, you know, I think a lot of people missed the deal on this money versus government thing.
Yeah.
Government has no effect on money. Government is a function of money.
Well, that's an interesting take on it.
I tell you what.
How so?
This from Guy de Rothschild. This is before they came to America and changed their name. I think he's back around the 1800s or something like that.
Well, the Rothschild banking family was very prominent in Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries, and Still is. I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah.
another part of the family makes very good wine. Anyhow, you were, so this quote from Guy Rothschild.
Yeah, he said, "Allow me to control the money. I care not who governs."
Yeah. Well, if I was a banker, I'd say the same thing.
But I'll tell you what, doesn't that give you a clue? Who government is?
Who's
not
really
government.
In charge? Yeah,
government
the bottom line.
Is not government. Government is money.
Yeah, interesting, interesting. Rich, thanks for the call. Harvey in Seattle. Hey, Harvey.
Yeah.
Harvey? Harvey, you got to listen to the actual, to the telephone, not to the radio here. I'm going to put you on hold, and we'll come back to you in a second. Will in Pittsburgh. Hey, Will.
Hey, Tom. My favorite Thomas. I'm
Thank
the starting
you.
Thomas here in Pittsburgh. I wanted to ask you questions, and I don't want to make comments. Love your show, Tom.
Thank you.
The Rothschilds and Prescott Bush, you never bring him up. I think the Bushes are probably the most corrupt family that ever...
Prescott was. Bush was a banker.
And he was involved with the Rothschilds.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, and Brown Brothers Harriman and all that stuff. I mean, you know, that's where the initial Bush fortunes came from, was the banking industry. They were you know, co-financing Hitler with the Thyssens, or however it's said, you know, auf Deutsch. But still, that doesn't answer the question, what do we do about that? In
okay,
the United
I'll
States?
Tell you what. You want my answer?
Sure.
I'll tell you what. The Bank of England. Who owns the Bank of England? Do you know?
I believe it is a privately owned central bank, just like we have here in the United States.
You're right, Tom. It is private bankers.
Yeah.
Now,
in fact, I'm quite sure of that. And it goes back to like the 1600s, back to the 17th century that it was a private bank, and maybe before that.
Your favorite president, what was his name? Second World War.
Roosevelt.
My favorite
president was Jefferson, Roosevelt.
Well, that's mine is Thomas Paine. Yeah. Anyhow, he never made it.
The only president of the United States who was never president of the United States.
He was a guy, man.
Actually,
he
that's what I say.
Constitution of Pennsylvania.
Ben Franklin.
By the way. Anyhow,
Will, just have a couple
an
seconds.
Ounce of gold. There's not an ounce of gold down at Fort Knox. Do you know that?
No, I didn't. I don't believe it. I know that they've reduced the gold inventory, but
there is not 1 ounce of gold at Fort Knox. It's all in England, in private hands.
Okay. Well,
you check it out, Tom.
I will. I will. Thanks for the heads up, Will. 45 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I've seen mornings when 1,000 bales of hay look like a mountain to a boy my age. And I've seen my daddy in that hot southern sun move those mountains one by one. I've seen that same man come home from the mill, pull 40 hours for $100 bill. I've watched him struggle, and I've watched him age, raising a family on a working man's wage. I grew up on a working man's wage. Blood, sweat, and tears on every dollar he made. I don't want to back.
Broadcasting, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, also known as Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio, by the way, brought to you by Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, 1-800-425-2532, sacredgroundscoffee.com, and Small Dog Electronics. Get the latest iPods now, 1-800-511-MAX, and smalldog.com. Ellen Ratner on the line with us in Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Ellen, we've been discussing the Federal Reserve Board and banking here for this last hour. First of all, anything big breaking in Washington?
Well, the only big breaking thing, of course, is the president's press conference with Mr. Karzai from Afghanistan, and he's actually going to be having dinner with Afghanistan's president, Karzai, and Musharraf tomorrow night. But he's now going to be releasing this leaked report because he thinks that the Americans need to read everything about it. And, of course, this is the famous tactic of kill them with too much information, and then the story will go away once you've got your, you know, caught with your pants down.
Yeah.
That's exactly the tactic that they're using.
He's gonna release it unredacted?
Supposedly. I mean, there may be parts that are redacted, but I'll tell you, supposedly he's releasing, you know, pretty much the whole thing.
Yeah.
And we'll see what comes of that. But this is just a tactic because they got absolutely caught with it.
Yeah. Do you know anything about
at the same time, Tom, they're putting out, of course, I don't get this, that the RNC is churning out stuff about, well, you know, you Democrats were upset when Valerie Plame's name was released, but you're not upset about this leak. And, I had a huge fight with one of my hosts saying, hey, one is somebody's personal life being ruined, and the other is the country not being, the president not being honest with the country. They're very different situations.
Well, and Valerie Plame wasn't just
trying to play it.
Yeah, Valerie Plame incident wasn't just somebody's personal life. I mean, she was the head of Brewster Jennings, which was a worldwide enterprise that the CIA was using to infiltrate terrorist groups. They were running around the world saying, we'll sell you weapons on the side. They had agents in countries all over the world, particularly in the Middle East. And we don't, to this day, know how many of those agents were murdered once that information that Brewster Jennings was a CIA front group was made public. You know, it's a very reasonable guess that a number of them were. And the Bush administration refuses to tell us how many CIA agents died as a result of the outing of Valerie Plame. So, I mean, you know, an entire operation was brought down. Do you know anything about the Federal Reserve Bank and private banking in the United States and what, you know, all that kind of thing?
Not
conflict?
As much as I should, but ask away and maybe I can.
Well, let's get a couple of callers in here and maybe between the two of us, we'll Harvey in Seattle. Hey, Harvey.
Hi, Tom. I'd just like to give you a little perspective on the banking system, on the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
And that is you might be able to look at it as a it goes back to the days of Thomas Jefferson, the founding of our country, and that is a sine cosine kind of curve in which restriction of money in the economy is paramount to the rich people having money, and the liberation of money so that it gets out into circulation, and it
creates
out
middle class. Is that the argument you're making?
That's correct, and you can see that in the Cross of Gold speech by Bryant, and you can also see it in that debate that they had with between gold and silver.
Yeah, no, I understand. And William James Bryant thought that you know that he was actually opposed to, unless I have this wrong, he was opposed to there being a national bank.
Right, and what you have is like I say, there's, you know, if you take the a sine cosine curve and say like the cosine could be Jefferson's idea and Hamilton could be the sine curve, you can see how those things kind of weave themselves through the American economy.
Yeah, I don't know, Harvey. I get the point, but I'm not buying it. My take on it is that the first middle class came about because there was a lot of free land and slave labor, and that created the middle class of the late 1700s. And then the second middle class came about starting in the late 1930s, early 1940s, because Roosevelt went in and tinkered with the rules of laissez-faire economics and said we're going to have a regulated capitalist system. And the reason why it's fallen apart is because Reagan came in and said, no, we're going to undo what Roosevelt did, and they've been systematically doing it. Ellen, thoughts on this?
Well, I do think that they're systematically trying to undo anything that Roosevelt did, and I think they're also systematically trying to undo anything that Clinton did, and that has been the policy of this administration.
Yeah, in fact, here's Rush Limbaugh on that topic.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah, take apart Social Security, take apart the whole thing. Ellen Renner, TalkRadioNews.com, Talk Radio News Service. Thanks, Ellen. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be back want to get into the GOP's top 10 voter qualifications. What does it take to be a voter? If you're the Republican, you know, it's they got a new plan. Got to share that with you. And habeas corpus, right after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, we got to look at it. The secret top 10 voter qualifications the RNC is circulating. What are going to be the new... As you know, the Republicans are passing laws all over in states all across the United States and at a federal level to make it harder and harder for people to vote. Because the bottom line is that they know that the fewer people vote, the easier it is to control an election. Particularly the rabble. Can't have the rabble voting. So they got a new plan here. This is from satiricalpolitical.com. Confidential sources have now revealed that the GOP is trying to enact even more exacting poll tests as part of their scheme to steal yet another election. Here, then, from the home office of Palm Beach County, are the top 10 GOP voting qualifications. Number 10, you must have a driver's license and you must have a driver. Number 9, you must have membership in an all-white country club. Number 8, you must have marriage to a trophy wife with a girlfriend on the side. Number 7, you must have a second home located outside the country. Number 6, at least one indictment for tax evasion settled with payments from a trust fund. Number 5, two last names followed by a Roman numeral. Number 4, employment of an illegal nanny, gardener, and personal assistant. Number 3, a complete set of monogrammed underwear. Number 2, subscriptions to the opera, ballet, and the National Review. And number 1, you must have French cuffs, a German car, and a Swiss bank account. If you can demonstrate all those things, then satiricalpolitical.com says the Republicans say, then you can vote. Then it's okay. The generals are speaking out. The Democrats, since they don't have subpoena power and they can't hold a real, you know, the real kind of hearing where you can call Don Rumsfeld before and say, okay, tell us what's going on here. They nonetheless can rent a room and invite people to come and talk to them. And that's, you know, basically what they've done. This General Batiste, General John R.S. Batiste, U.S. Army retired. He's a major general. He served in Iraq. He testified at this hearing that the Democratic Policy Committee held yesterday on oversight of the Bush administration. And General Batiste had a few things to say. Now, keep in mind, this is a general who was commanding troops in the field in Iraq. A major general. John Batiste.
Bottom line, our nation is in peril. Our Defense Department's leadership is extraordinarily bad, and our Congress is only today, more than 5 years into this war, beginning to exercise its oversight responsibilities. This is all about accountability and setting our nation up for victory. There is no substitute for victory, and I believe we must complete what we started in Iraq and Afghanistan. Donald Rumsfeld is not a competent wartime leader. He knows everything except how to win.
Donald Rumsfeld knows everything except how to win. He talks about Rumsfeld's strategic decisions. This is General Batiste again yesterday speaking before this hearing that the Democrats are holding.
Secretary Rumsfeld's dismal strategic decisions resulted in the unnecessary deaths of American servicemen and women, our allies, and the good people of Iraq. He was responsible for America and our allies going to war with the wrong plan and a strategy that did not address the realities of fighting an insurgency.
Batiste went on to say,
Secretary Rumsfeld built his team by systematically removing dissension. America went to war with his plan, and to say that he listens to his generals is disingenuous. We are fighting with his strategy. He reduced force levels to unacceptable levels, micromanaged the war, and caused delays in the approval of troop requirements and the deployment process, which tied the hands of commanders while our troops were in contact with the enemy. At critical junctures, commanders were forced to focus on managing shortages rather than leading, planning, and anticipating opportunity. Through all of this, our congressional oversight committees were all but silent and not asking the tough questions, as was done routinely during both World Wars, Korea, and Vietnam. Our Congress shares responsibility for what is and is not happening in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Our Republican Congress. He pointed out during World War One, even though Democrats controlled the White House and Congress, they held hearings. During World War II, they held hearings into this. Korean War hearings. The Vietnam War, when Lyndon Johnson was president, you had Fulbright, the Democratic senator from Wisconsin, standing up and holding hearings investigating LBJ and the war in Vietnam. That ain't going to happen now. No siree, Bob. The Republicans will not allow Republicans to question Republicans. That Democrats may have questioned Democrats during World War I. Democrats may have questioned Democrats during World War II. Republicans may have questioned Democrats during the Korean War. Democrats may have questioned Democrats during the Vietnam War. Republicans may have questioned Republicans during the Civil War. But not now. It's a different party. This is not Abe Lincoln's party. As General Eaton, General Paul D. Eaton, U.S. Army, also a major general, retired. These guys are retired, so they can speak out about it. Here's Paul Eaton on the same topic on the Iraq war plan.
I briefed this plan, second phase essentially, the operation given me, a requirement to adapt. Mr. Rumsfeld received this briefing on 5 September, and I got his approval to proceed with an accelerated, adapted plan that would produce an army of 27 battalions, essentially 40,000 personnel, associated command and control from national to squad, start the Navy, start the Air Force, the logistics systems, and a budget of $2.2 billion. We laid out the basing strategy for the Iraqi Armed Forces. He approved this plan, but he put his finger in my chest and said, just don't make this look like the American Army.
Say what? Just don't make this look like the American Army? General Eaton elaborates.
Mr. Rumsfeld came in to transform the U.S. military, to turn the military into a lighter, more lethal armed force. In fact, Rumsfeld's vision is a force designed to meet a Warsaw Pact-type force more effectively, but we are not fighting the Warsaw Pact. We are fighting an insurgency, a distributed, low-tech, high-concept war that demands greater numbers of ground forces, not fewer. Mr. Rumsfeld won't acknowledge this fact and has failed to adapt to the current situation. He has tried and continues to fight this war on the cheap.
And as a result, we now have more soldiers dead than we have people dead from 9/11. General Batiste, speaking yesterday on the lack of troops in preparation for an insurgency, again, laying this at the feet of Rumsfeld and ultimately at the feet of George W. Bush, because he's the boss.
I was privy to a meeting in 2002 where General Franks and some of his staff from U.S. Central Command was to have briefed Donald Rumsfeld on the plan. It didn't get very far. The numbers were too high. For whatever reason, they were ushered back to Tampa to try it again. And this process happened over and over and over again until the plan was finally whittled down to this unacceptable level that we all accepted back in March of 2003, completely ignored the insurgency, which was an absolute certainty, completely ignored the hard work after the fall of Saddam Hussein, deployed insufficient troops and capability to the Iraqi theater of war so that we could accomplish the mission.
an absolute failure, completely ignored. I mean, this is an indictment. These are the generals who served.
There's no joy in the Department of the Army. I'll speak for that. I know a lot of great officers that continue to serve our nation. This business of arrogance and dismissiveness and contemptuous behavior has certainly transcended the department. An organization reflects its leader, period.
Is it worse than it's been in the past?
Oh, it's absolutely worse. Now, I caveat by saying I've been out of the service now for 11 months, but I'm in close contact with a lot of great people. I have yet to be contacted by any serving general or admiral or flag officer to say, stop what you're doing. And as you know, I've been speaking out with some regularity since the 4th of April.
Have many of them contacted you and said, keep going?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Keep going. That's General Batiste. The other generals, admirals, flag officers contacting him saying, keep saying this stuff. We can't say it. We're in the active duty. If we say it, George Bush will bring us up on charges. We'll get the Lieutenant Watata treatment. By the way, thank you, LT.com, the website for Lieutenant Aaron Watata. Amazing. Tragic. By the way, you can now bring liquids on airplanes. More about that right after this. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Richard Foley owns one half of this whole town with political connections to spread his wealth around. Born into society, a banker's only child, he had everything a man could want, power, great size. But I work in his factory, and I curse the life I'm living, and I curse my poverty, and I wish that I could be, oh, I wish that I could be, oh, I wish that I could be.
Welcome back to the place where smart people get the news. Tom Hartman here with you, 22 minutes past the hour. And now you can bring liquids back on planes in relatively small quantities. And I suspect that what has happened is that the Bush administration got their bounce out of their, you know, let's scare the hell out of people with this phony, oh, these bombers in London, they're gonna put together these bombs. Yeah, they're going to do it. Here's how they're going to do it. They're going to use acetone and sulfuric acid, and they're going to get it on airplanes, and they're going to make the... And they figured out that it's crazy. Doesn't work. As we laid out on this program, what, months ago, several months ago, when they first started hyping this thing, and they've been hyping it ever since. This was not a threat. I mean, yes, there are liquid explosives. Nitroglycerin, for example. Carry it around in a bottle. It'll blow you up. On the other hand, it takes very little nitroglycerin. I mean, so what do? You pack it in cotton, and that's called dynamite. But then you have to have an explosive to detonate it. So the technology exists to find this stuff. They don't want to spend the money on that. But bringing on a bottle of liquid onto an airplane, no, that's not going to do it. It's got nothing to do with reality. As on this program, back, I don't recall the date. Here's how to build a bomb, right? And you can get how ridiculous this is. First, you've got to get adequately concentrated hydrogen peroxide. I talked about this a few days ago, last week, I believe it was. It has to be essentially pure hydrogen peroxide. The stuff they sell in the drugstores is 3%. So let's assume that you can obtain it in the required concentration, or you can cook it from a dilute solution without ruining your operation. Fine. The remaining ingredients, acetone and sulfuric acid, are pretty easy to obtain, so we can assume that you've got those on hand. Now for the fun part. Take your hydrogen peroxide, acetone, and sulfuric acid, measure them very carefully, and put them into drink bottles for convenient smuggling onto a plane. It's all right to mix the peroxide and acetone in one container so long as it remains cool. Don't forget to bring several frozen gel packs, preferably in a styrofoam chiller, deceptively marked perishable foods, a thermometer, a large beaker, a stirring rod, and a medicine dropper because you're going to need them. It's best to fly first class and order champagne. Why? Because it'll come with a bucket full of ice water, which you're going to need. Especially if you can get those cold gel packs to supplement the ice and you have a styrofoam chiller handy for insulation. This may get you through the process without catching yourself on fire. Okay, here. Once the plane is over the ocean, very discreetly bring all of your gear into the bathroom. You might need to make several trips to avoid drawing attention. Once your kit is in place, put a beaker containing the peroxide acetone mixture into the ice water bath. This is the champagne bucket. And start adding the sulfuric acid. You have to add it, however, drop by drop while stirring constantly. If you just pour it in, it'll blow up in your face. The plane won't go down, but you will. So you put it in drop by drop, and you watch the temperature with the thermometer that's in there, because as you add the acid, this is going to start heating up. So you have to add the acid very slowly. It could take as much as an hour. If it gets too hot, it will blow up. After a few hours, assuming by some miracle that the fumes haven't overcome you or alerted passengers or the flight crew to your activities, you will have a quantity of TATP with which to carry out your mission. All you need to do then is, at that point, it's a fairly liquid substance. You need to dry it out for an hour or two, let it cool down and evaporate some of the water out of it. Maybe spread it on a seat or something, I don't know. And then you can ignite it with your camera. Now, that was from August 18th. Now, what I didn't include in the instructions at the time, forgot to mention, you have to, what forms is a precipitate in this liquid, and you have to pour it through filter paper, and then you take the filter paper back to your seat and you dry it, and then you have the substance that you can ignite with your camera, right? This is nuts. It's impossible. Nobody can do this. So we have this hysterical response in the United States. Is France saying you can't carry liquids on planes? No. Is Spain, a country that was actually bombed by Islamic terrorists? No. Is Germany? No. They look at us, they say, you guys are nuts. Just England and the United States. Why? Well, could it have to do with the fact that we both have leaders who are only holding on to power by virtue of terrifying the populace? In any case, they said, okay, now you can have a few ounces. We've gotten so much flack from people, and the stores are not doing well. So if you're going to have a few ounces, you have to buy it at the store at the airport. Let's bring back American commerce. Yeah, that sounds like a plan. 866-440-8466, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, our chat room. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartmann.
Coup d'etat, oh coup d'etat, here we go again. Ohio and Florida, where losers go to win. Coup d'etat, oh coup d'etat, no one dares to say that's two elections in a row. They're laughing all the way. Welcome to the dark ages, where everyone is equal, except the ones who disagree with coup d'etat, the sequel. The sheep with the wool pulled over their eyes, Bush with his shock and awe, they really pulled it off this time. Second coup d'etat. Second coup d'etat.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, the Tom Hartmann Program, 35 minutes past the hour, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Alan in Ithaca, New York. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom, how are you?
I'm fine. What's up?
I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about key TAM cases. I heard Robert Kennedy and Mike Papantonio talk about it way back in June, I think. They said that they were going to get at Diebold and ES&S and companies like that by way of a Ketam case.
Mm-hmm. They were going to be filing some lawsuits based on fraud in Ohio specifically. Was that Robert Kennedy Jr. was on this program, and I'm pretty sure that he made that point. I frankly don't know the details of those suits. Although Bobby Kennedy's going to be on the program, isn't he?
Yeah, we have changed it to Tuesday.
Tuesday of next week.
Yeah, Tuesday.
Okay, so we'll ask him then.
Oh, great, yeah. Find out for me.
I'll do it. Thanks a lot, Alan.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Peter in Durham, North Carolina. Hey, Peter, what's on your mind today?
I hope it's not too late to talk a little bit more about the Federal Reserve.
That's fine. We were talking about it earlier in the program.
Yeah.
What's up?
Yeah. A lot of people don't realize that, roughly two-thirds of your tax dollars go to paying the interest on the national debt.
Right.
Which is basically completely unnecessary. When we have a federal banking system that is basically controlled by an elite, rich, and powerful group that are really not needed. Our Constitution calls for our own treasury to be issuing our currency. And we could basically eliminate the federal debt right now by issuing currency in the amount of the capital that's out there, and then require.
But if you do that, then that's what the Germans did in the 1920s. You do that, and suddenly your currency, the value of your currency, goes to the floor.
Let's say
there's no Fed for just a second, and the government intends to spend more money than it has coming in taxes, and there is no Fed. We have a nationalized bank. At that point, they still would have to sell instruments of debt. They still would have to pay interest.
No, they do exactly what the Fed does. They create money out of nothing, just as exactly.
But then you have inflation.
No, you require the banks to have 100% reserves. The banks right now create money out of nothing because of our fractional reserve banking system.
Right.
They are only required to hold 10%. So if you put $1,000 in the bank and they get 8% on your $1,000, they're really getting 80% because they can loan out $10,000.
No, I understand that. In fact, I talked about that early in the program. In fact, when it comes to mortgages, they're making even more than that. I mean, it's mind-boggling, the profitability of a mortgage, because people think they're paying 5%. No, actually, in the first year, you're paying 95%.
Right.
Yeah, interest.
So basically what I'm saying is that they are creating money out of nothing, and the U.S. Treasury can basically do the same thing. In other words, they would only increase money supply to facilitate economic expansion and economic growth. That's exactly what Abraham Lincoln did when he floated the greenback. He went to the National Bank and wanted to borrow money for supporting the Civil War, and they wanted to charge some exorbitant interest rate, and his own economic advisor said, you don't need them, the Constitution affords for the Treasury to float your own currency, so float your own currency with any amount you need, and fight your war and win it. This is all very well covered in the program that the guy mentioned earlier, The Money Masters.
Mm-hmm.
It's an excellent movie. I highly recommend it. You can buy it online.
Okay,
I don't make any money from it.
No, I understand that. So Lincoln went to, at that point, the national, whatever bank he went to was the precursor of the Fed. It was private, was it not?
Exactly. It was the National Bank.
It was the National Bank. And it was essentially, wasn't it interlocked with the national banks of Europe at that point?
Yes, it was.
Okay. So this was
the National Bank of Europe. But it was, and that was partially why broke out the War of Independence with England, was because of the taxation that England wanted to impose on us by the National Bank.
Sure. So how did Lincoln float the greenback? You say floated the greenback. What does that mean?
It just meant they printed currency that was backed by the United States Treasury. You make it able to be.
But it was backed by gold.
No, not necessarily. It was backed by the United States Treasury.
Lincoln took us off the gold standard.
Well, in effect, he did. Yes. But see, all you need is to make that currency capable of paying your taxes with.
There was something called a
talisik back in the Middle Ages that was nothing more than a carved stick that then was split in half, the king would keep half of that stick, and you would float the other half. So, you know, what is money? What is it backed with? It's just backed with...
Yeah, it's just a medium of exchange. Now, in the 30s, when Roosevelt made it illegal to own gold, was he putting us back on the gold standard as a consequence of Lincoln having us taken us off the gold standard?
Well, I'm not really sure exactly what the motive was there. I think it partially had to do with certain shortages of gold and the need to finance it internationally for the wars. But I'm not sure exactly what went on
before we entered the war.
But you see, these same international bankers, and yeah, it gets into the whole conspiracy thing,
yeah.
They have been fighting, you know, the efforts of the legitimate government to float its own currency, because obviously this is hugely profitable for them,
sure,
to have their own bank, us paying them interest. In effect, all of Americans are working for the Federal Reserve, paying them taxes. That's also why they wanted to back women in the workforce, to increase, you know, their taxable income.
You're getting into the... Yeah, I think you're getting into the margins of conspiracy theory.
Well, yeah, I am getting a little into the margins of conspiracy theories, but I believe there is a conspiracy to it, obviously. When you're talking about ultimate control of society, because we all have to work to pay our taxes, just think about how much more money would be available if we didn't have to pay the interest on the national debt. The amount of currency that we need to pay it all off.
But what you're suggesting then is the government should have the ability to simply spend whatever it wants and reduce the value of the currency by that amount, assuming that that amount exceeds the rate of the growth of the domestic economy. In other words, the theory is that the Fed increases the money supply at the same rate that the economy is increasing, and then that keeps the money current stable. You know,
and why is it that our government can't do that?
Well, hang on just a second. The reality is that if you take a dollar in 1910, the purchasing power of a dollar today is 4 cents in terms of 1910, right? So the reality is that the Fed has been slowly eroding the value of the dollar.
Exactly.
And the conspiracy theory, and I'm not discounting it, and I don't mean that in a dismissive fashion, that the bankers have been putting that other 96 cents in their pocket, basically,
That's exactly right.
Right. So now, if the government was issuing the currency and they started issuing more currency than they started issuing currency faster than the economy was growing, you'd have the same situation. You'd have the value of the dollar dropping.
Well,
shouldn't there be some kind of a check on that? I mean, isn't that essentially a dangerous thing?
Absolutely. I mean, it has to be done with, you know, constraint to facilitate the, you know, the need.
So the Fed comes along
expansion.
And says, "Where's the check on it?"
The check would be, you know, obviously employing people in the government that have economic knowledge to know where the boundaries are, just exactly like the Fed does now. Only we don't have to pay anybody interest on it. That's the total bottom line, is we do exactly what they're doing, facilitating, contracting money supply when, you know, inflation gets too big by pulling back dollars in and letting dollars out when we need them. There's no reason for there to be a national debt.
Interesting. Peter, thank you.
Watch the movie The Money Masters.
I intend to.
It's
thank
about
you.
3 hours long.
Yeah,
so
I'll check it out.
Two parts.
Thanks.
All right.
John in Las Vegas. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. On The Money Masters,
yeah.
They do recommend a solution. As I recall, it's near the end of the program. I was able to locate it, the part two of two, on video.google.com.
So you can watch the whole thing online?
Well, part two of two. I can't find part one of two, but I had gotten it previously through another source that no longer exists.
Uh-huh.
So just so everybody knows out there that... you can get that for free if you can get on video.google.com.
Right. Okay, cool.
And also regarding Russo's movie, Freedom to Fascism, he wants to replicate Michael Moore. He really needs to put out CDs, and I think eventually he'll understand that. But that's a great movie, too.
Interesting. Okay, I got to check it out. John, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Telling the truth to multinational corporations and apparently the banks would rather you didn't know about. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
I was burned out from exhaustion, buried in the hail, poisoned in the bushes and blown out on the trail. Hunted like a crocodile, ravaged in the corn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
Helping you with the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. In the real free speech zone, no RNC pass required, no barbed wire. No, you can get it right up close. You can call anytime you want, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Michael in Anacortes, Washington. Am I pronouncing that right, Michael?
Yes, yes, you are.
Hey, Michael, what's up?
Oh, thank you, Tom, for taking my call. I love your show. I wanted to say something that sort of is a good segue into what you mentioned about the whole business about the Democrats and Rumsfeld and the generals coming forth. With elections approaching, Republicans have always been very good at sound bites. And my feeling is that Democrats tend to overwhelm the general public with too much information. And again, I'm talking about the general public. But and underscoring, for instance, lying and corruption, which unfortunately, as much as I know that it's significant in this in the Republican administration, it's also indicative of both parties. What we need to do is find a soundbite that will underscore, I think, issues that people are going to really listen to, and that is incompetence. Incompetence, incompetence, incompetence of the Bush administration.
But here's the problem, Michael. George W. Bush wanted to invade Iraq. He did. He wanted to get control of Iraq's oil supplies. He did. He wanted to further trash unions. He did. He wanted to reduce environmental regulations. He did. He wanted to open the wilderness areas to logging. He did. I mean, you go right on down through the list, and he has been very competent.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on those issues. What I'm talking about, though, is the major, major failures of this administration from and the Republican Congress, which is what these generals basically have said, have supported this from 9/11 to Katrina to Iraq to the environment to the national debt. They have shown serious, serious incompetence. And if you're going to get the attention of moderate Republicans and independents, you need to underscore that, because I agree with you on all those other things that Bush has pushed through, but
no, but I would say even the ones that you just mentioned, Katrina, Bush wanted the private sector instead of the public sector to respond, and that's how he had it.
But you know,
and now he's able to say, see, government doesn't work.
No, because his government, he chose, you know, a fish starts to rot.
From the head down, no. Yeah. No, I agree with you that the incompetence is probably a good meme and that the Democrats should use it.
I don't think,
though, that those of us who have any political savvy at all should ever for a minute believe that these guys are incompetent, because they are absolutely doing what they want. And the real issue, in my mind, is not incompetence, it's ideology. It's the fact that Katrina is a symptom of ideology, that Iraq is a symptom of the ideology. You know, he wanted to get a couple of conservatives on the Supreme Court. He did it. What we're seeing is right-wing ideology, and I would love to see the day when enough Americans are sufficiently politically sophisticated to be able to say, you know, I guess it's all about the right-wingers getting their way, and gee, it wasn't the way that we all wanted. And I think it's unfortunate that the Democrats are going to have to say, instead of that, they're going to, and they could have said that back, you know, 20, 30 years ago, and everybody would have understood what they were talking about. But now, you know, the public has been so dumbed down, and, you know, we haven't taught civics in our schools since Reagan was president, that we have to use the incompetence.
Well, I agree. And that's why I think it's naive for people like you and I to think that when I go out and I get into these arguments about the lying and the corruption and the history, people start to shut down because they don't even know the history of our government. And I'm talking about people from who were educated in the 60s and the 70s.
Yeah.
But if we expect to win this election, we have got to get savvy at marketing and promotion, and we have to start thinking about what people can actually digest and hear and really act on. And quite honestly, I think that is, if you're talking about winning the election or you're talking about educating the public, educating the general public that's a long haul.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to win this election, we need to get really serious about looking at ways to get people's attention. And to me, I mean, you know, one of the things I'll say about Nixon is as corrupt and as much as I hated that administration, you know, the fact is that typically, though, they were not necessarily incompetent on the major issues. If you're talking about Iraq, I think, you know, I may have supported invasion of Iraq based on the facts, and I'm what I would call a moderate, okay? But what the fact is that they went in, even if they had gone in based on the facts that we know that we would have known at the time, and they decided, okay, well, we're just going to go in because he's not agreeing with that we can look at all his different arms and everything. If we just went in on that basis alone, or the fact that he was, decimating, certain parts of the population.
So your point is that the occupation has been incompetent. But,
exactly.
But my point is that the occupation has been quite competent. It's there's been an unintended consequence. But they were going to remake Iraq. And Naomi Klein wrote a brilliant piece about this called Iraq Year Zero, a year and a half, 2 years ago in The Nation. They were going to remake Iraq as a neoconservative paradise. They wanted to reinvent it the way that they want America to be. And that's what they did. L. Paul Bremer, George Bush's old roommate from Andover, went in and rewrote the Constitution, which is a violation of international law. But he did it anyway and put in a 15% flat tax, did away with all national barriers and boundaries, did away with tariffs, started privatizing, did away with the Social Security program, started privatizing their health system, started privatizing their schools, and this is the result.
I agree with you, but I still think the bottom line is
meme is the one we should use.
Yeah. I really
okay.
do.
Okay. Well, I'm not disagreeing with you. And the rest of us need to keep understanding the real issues behind it all. Michael, thank you for the call and for listening. And there on Talk 1090 in Seattle, much appreciated. Coming up tomorrow. David Tebow is going to be with us, isn't he, David? Yeah, we're going to be talking with David Tebow. He's out of the hospital. He'll be back. And Jeffrey Feldman will be here. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.